Hello and welcome to the Tips for Teachers podcast with me, Craig Barton. Now, you may be noticing some background noise because in a Tips for Teachers world exclusive, I am here live in Piccadilly Station, Manchester, in the great northwest of England, but I'm not on my own. I am joined by my longtime podcast co-host, conference takeaway resource queen, Jo Morgan. Hello, Jo.
Hello, Craig.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Great conference today, and looking forward to a nightmare journey home later because the trains are not in a good way.
No, it's not good, but it doesn't matter because we're here, we're doing a podcast, that's all that counts. So this is one of our conference takeaway podcasts. Now, long-time listeners of the Mr. Barton Maths podcast will know all about these. We've done them from everywhere, Joe, haven't we? We're saying we've done them from Alton Towers.
That was the best. It was like 30 degrees sitting out in front of a roller coaster. Yep.
We've done them from hotels when we've had a bit to drink on the way.
Yeah, we did it. Do you remember University of Warwick and we did it in the student halls? Yep.
We've done it. We were going to do one in a spa, but the conference got cancelled.
That was unfortunate. COVID cancelled the spa conference.
But now we're in the glamorous location of Piccadilly Station, Manchester. So you may hear some rail announcements, but we'll just go with it. So the way we're going to structure this, a bit different, to fit in with the Tips for Teachers theme, is we've been to the LaSalle Maths Comp 30. We've each run a session and we've seen four sessions in addition to that. And I've tasked Jo with trying to come up with five tips for teachers from all the sessions that she's seen. I've come up with five. I've no idea what Jo's is. Jo doesn't know what mine is. So we're just going to tell each other our tips and see where we go. So Jo Morgan, let's start with you. What's tip number one, please?
Okay, so tip number one is assess prerequisites. And this is something that was talked about in Stuart Welsh's session, which was called Think Fast, the Art of Responding in the Moment.
Nice.
And was really about responsive teaching. And there was a point in it where he said he doesn't like end of topic tests. Now, I love my end-of-topic
test. Yeah, me too.
And what we do at my school is we have a thing called a learning snapshot, which is an end-of-topic test that's done in... So all subjects do them, and they all have them... They're all on yellow paper, and that sounds like enough... And like, who cares what colour paper they're on? But actually, the students take them really seriously because they know that they're sitting in a lesson with something that's across the school. Every subject does it the same. And our snapshots in maths have... They have the topic we've just learnt. So, for example, my Year 10s did one last week on trigonometry, sine and cosine rule.
Yep.
And then at the end, they have some retrieval questions on stuff that that isn't in that topic we've just learnt. But normally it's stuff that they've been doing in their lesson warm-ups. So,
yes.
Say, for example, I've recently been doing expanding double brackets in the lesson warm-up, then there'll be a question in the snapshot on that. And that helps increase engagement in the warm-ups because they know they'll be tested on that stuff. So it's interesting when Stuart said he doesn't like end-of-topic tests, but he said, I tell you what's more important, is testing prerequisites. And that was really interesting because it links to something I learned at another conference I went to.
Yeah.
So last week I went to the Pixel conference where I was speaking, and there was an excellent speaker called Tom, and I can't remember his surname, but he was very good. And he talked about assessment, and he said that assessments in maths, end-of-topic assessments, should have three things in them. They should have... retrieval questions.
Yes.
They should have the topic you've just done, because
yes.
You do want to, you know, even though, yes, they might forget it in a few weeks, it is helpful
to
see.
Of course.
And then he said they should also have a couple of questions on the prerequisites for the next topic.
Nice.
And I thought, why have I never thought of that?
That's
so
good.
You know, just like after half term, I'm doing quadratics with my year 10s, so I could have asked some questions that would help me understand the starting
yes.
point for quadratics. Or with my year 11s, I've just given them a snapshot on histograms. And I could have put a couple of questions on angles because we're doing circle theorems
next, and it would have
helped me assess my starting point. So I thought this was a nice link between the two conferences I've been to this week, and it's really just a very sensible and kind of almost obvious thing to do that somehow I haven't quite picked up on. I know some people do give pre-tests, and we don't do that at my school, but including prerequisite skill questions in end-of-unit tests, I thought very sensible.
I like that. And no reason it couldn't work for homeworks as well, right? Like, if as long as the kids do the homework and take it seriously, that's nice.
I guess the thing is that, you know, so at my school we do Hegarty homework, and that means that we're not really, apart from monitoring that they're doing
looking
at it. But I suppose what we've, and the other challenge would be, like, I'm a bit of an obsessed with, if I give a test, I like to mark it that evening and return it the next lesson. So obviously it's always better to give it on like the last lesson you see them that week, and then it gives you a few days extra to do it. So I'll like sell it later, mark it, because I just really want to give it back to the next lesson. Whereas some of my colleagues who've got like maybe more classes than me might take a bit longer to mark it, and then that's then not going to work. So I think this may have been David's suggestion. David Farham suggested that you could put in, say, you could just mark the three prerequisite questions. So if you haven't got time to mark the entire test, at least you can go through and mark those prerequisite questions before you start your next lesson. And that's quite smart, I think. So good idea from David.
Good tip, that. I like that one. Very, very good. Okay, right. Tip one from me. Very quick one. So I went to Andrew Taylor's session where he was reviewing AQA summer exams, blah, blah, blah. And I put a Twitter thread out on this, and I'll link to it in the show notes, of questions where kids did worse than you would expect them to do and questions where they did better than you'd expect them to do. And they were really interesting ones, and he kind of delved into the reasons why. And one recurring theme was units. As soon as any question needs kids to do anything with a unit, they do crap on it, basically. So he shared a really interesting one where it was fascinating. It was a triangle, and two of the sides were marked in maybe centimetres and one of them in millimetres or something like that. And all they had to do was write as a fraction the shorter side over the longer side. And they just couldn't do it because they had to convert the units.
But is it that they can't do it or they're not spotting the units are different?
Well, either way, units, I think, need a big focus from teachers.
Because either that's a silly, that's carelessness and rushing. Because last week I did a question on the board. I was going through a question where there were different units that I didn't spot.
Yeah,
and then one of my students said, says millimetres. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's not that I don't know how to do it. So it's actually, you have to sort of figure out, is it that they don't know how or is it that they're rushing? But that's interesting, isn't it? You know, isn't it? I tell you something about units that interests me is that when they're in, as far as I know, in Key Stage 2 SATs, they never have to write the units and it's always written there for them.
When we
used to do a baseline test in Year 7, and we would write, include units with your answer, say on an area question, they didn't know what that instruction meant. Like, they literally didn't know, what does this mean, include units with your answer? So that's something that Year 7 teachers need to be aware of, that instruction is something they'll need to explain.
That's good. So my tip is just make sure cover units more, basically. Make sure they can do the conversions and practice. And again, it's the classic thing, either write the units in before you do the working out of the answer or whatever it takes, but units are a problem.
Yes.
Right, Joe, tip two.
Use a variety of techniques for differentiation. So this was from a session that I was sitting with you in, which was from two excellent speakers involved in White Rose.
Yes.
So this was Ian, what's Ian's surname? Ian Davis. And it was Matt, and this is one, I don't know how to pronounce the surname, so apologies if I did it wrong. Ainscough, I think, or something like that. So, brilliant session. I really enjoyed it. In fact, you were laughing at me because I was literally opened up my scheme of work and edited it in the session based on what they were saying. So the thing about differentiation was they were talking about how you adapt your lesson for the class in front of you. And they said there's a whole load of techniques you can do. So if you're taking an off-the-shelf PowerPoint and you want to edit it for your class, they talked about choice of numbers, whether you let them use calculators. You know, if you're doing angles with a weaker class, just let them use a calculator, or even with anyone, let them use a calculator. Choice of questions, removing elements, providing elements, rewording things, and basically adapting the level of support that you're providing. But there's all these lovely techniques to make an off-the-shelf lesson suitable for the particular group in front of you. So, you know, it's nice to think about like different ways that you can decrease or increase level of challenge.
Yeah, well, I had a related one on this, so let's box this off now as well. I've got adapt off-the-shelf resources from the same session, but specifically, so I'm very lucky these days, I get to visit tons of schools, and I see one of two things happening with lessons quite a lot. So I either see off-the-shelf lessons being used exactly as they're presented, and the teachers are clicking through slide after slide after slide, and it's really problematic. There's no flexibility to it. There's no chance to adapt if either the kids are struggling or the kids are going quicker than you think. Or you see others where you've got novice teachers trying to do everything from scratch and they really struggle. So it seems to me like the perfect balance is, let's have an off-the-shelf thing available, whether it's something like White Rose or whether, like you were talking about, how you have your lessons that you plan out available for your staff.
Yeah.
But then spend the time adapting it,
yes,
as opposed to starting from scratch. I think that's quite hard for a lot of teachers.
Yes.
So start with something decent,
yeah,
but then do exactly what you're saying, and adapt from there.
Yeah, and it was interesting that Matt was acknowledging that he said that he can have two set 2 year 9 classes where he wants, he thinks he can use the same lesson, and he can't use the same lesson because they're different classes.
Yes.
So it's interesting because we're told to not that we should use off-the-shelf lessons because it reduces our workload, but they were acknowledging, and they did a really good job of explaining why you have to look at those lessons in advance, and you have to kind of fix them so they're right for your group in front of you. I thought it was good that they acknowledged that.
Really good. Okay, so I'll do tip two because this was from your session, Joe. So you did one on area in depth, one of your classic in depth sessions, award winning in depth sessions. So this one, you do all the classics, you go through what they should know from primary, misconceptions, and so on, and so on. And then you get to your favourite one where you do all the resources.
Yeah.
So my tip was very, very simple, and just for maths teachers, don't forget the old classics, because you shared, well, one resource I'd completely forgotten about that I love from the standards unit.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one.
Which is a brilliant one, and I'll link to that in the show notes. I took a photo from all the resources from your session on Twitter. But then also, I always forget the smile resources until you share them.
Yeah.
And they're just, they're really good. They're almost kind of like the precursors to a lot of Don Stewart's tasks. And
Absolutely. And that's, it was, the one that I showed where there's that boxing in method where you, if you want to find an area of an awkward shape, you can draw a box around it and then subtract the bits around the outside. Like, it's interesting that I saw the Don Stewart task on it, and I thought, that reminds me of a smile task.
Yeah.
And then I found it in the old Hayling's textbook, and that's where I got the phrase boxing in. But I think a lot of Don Stewart's stuff is kind of, it's because it's all reasoning based, and that's what smile
was.
But new teachers can go to STEM Centre and look for the smile resources, and the only problem is the files are scans, so they're not great quality, but they're totally usable.
Of course.
Really good stuff.
And just a little bonus one on that boxing in, you made a really good point. So for listeners who don't know, boxing in is if you've got like a weird looking shape with like diagonal lines and so on squared paper, you essentially kind of draw a rectangle around it through all the vertices and then subtract triangles. And you made the point, Joe, that that's actually harder than, well, kids find it harder than you perhaps imagine to do.
Yes.
And but it's good practice of area of a triangle, identifying perpendicular lengths and all that kind of thing.
And it's good sort of, it kind of reinforces the concept of area being the number of squares covered. And there's lots of reasoning in there. And then, because sometimes older year groups, we've got to questions where they have to subtract something, or they try and find an area of a shape in a really long-winded way. And I say, well, can't you just, subtract this bit? And it's a really useful skill. So it's good to sort of do that kind of thing in year seven, where we shouldn't just say, well, they've done area before, so let's just skip over it. We should say, well, they've done area before, so let's go into greater depth by doing that kind of thing.
Exactly. So I'll put links to the images I shared in the show notes. So I've done three tips now, Jo, so it must be your tip three, maybe.
My tip three, yes. So this is... plan the curriculum that's suitable for the classes you teach. Now, obviously, we are told the curriculums to teach by, so we've got the national curriculum, and then our schools that we work in interpret that into a scheme of work. But then, again, this is in the same session by Ian and Matt from White Rose. They did this wonderful example of congruence and similarity, and they said, here's all the steps, all the things you need to cover, and then figure out if you were teaching a group in year 10 working at a grade 3 or 4, which bits would you teach? If you had a grade 8 or 9 group, which bits? And then the sort of trickier, the 5-6 group. And obviously, if you've got the foundation group, you don't have to teach any of the higher stuff, and that gives you more time for the more time to focus on the things they really need, like, starting with a refresher on enlargement. Whereas with your higher group, you might say, well, they probably know how to do enlargement from key stage 3. Obviously, you check that, but then you can spend some time on negative enlargement.
Yes.
And then it was like, with your higher group, you're going to do those congruency proofs, you're going to do those volume and area scale factors. And with your foundation group, like they were talking about where you might want to focus your time. And it's similar to the thing they were saying about adapting the lessons themselves, and they're talking about that skill of adapting the curriculum. Because, every teacher needs to do that. Like, unless you're in a school where the sequence you teach is planned, and you're not allowed to deviate from that, then we're all kind of responding to our class and changing things as we go in terms of the sequence of lessons. And it was a really good example of that, because it's a topic that kind of spans a lot of difficulty levels.
Yes, and just related to that, this isn't a tip, but I always think it's worth thinking if the order that your scheme of work of the objectives within a unit is the right order to tell the story you want to tell.
Yeah.
I'm going deep here, right? So obviously, like, you've a certain amount of objectives you've got to cover, and as you say, you want to think for your class, which ones am I going to get to, and blah blah blah. But then also, if you're leaving some out, it might make sense just to rejig the order, just to tell a more coherent narrative how you introduce things. So I often find teachers are quite rigid in terms of sticking to the order, but you don't need to, right? You know, you choose the order you do things.
Yes, absolutely.
Right, Joe Morgan. Well, my last two are from the final session, so you might as well do your tip four now then, because I think your last one will be from that session.
So my tip is to deepen understanding of a topic by looking at boundary examples.
Hey, good, sounds good.
And this is from your session, which was very, very good. I got a lot of ideas from it. I don't like to flatter you, Craig, but it was very good. And this was all about learner-generated examples, which... I spoke at a conference yesterday where I was talking about how you can get a lot of challenge out of learner-generated examples, and I showed your MathsFens website, which is a really good example of how that works. But then the three different models you showed today, I thought were particularly powerful, and obviously perhaps you can put in the show notes some links to some pictures that I took and shared on Twitter those. But they were the one example that I wanted to mention was this one about quadratics.
Yes.
So you had to sort of split the page into four, and this would be done maybe on a mini whiteboard, and then it was like, right, in the top left corner, write a quadratic that can be factorised, then write another quadratic that can be factorised. And the thing is, that's so simple for us, not going to be simple for my students. I'm teaching quadratics to year 10 straight after half term, and I've got a class that are working at around a grade 4.
I
know that they won't just immediately think, oh, I could just put some brackets and expand them and see. Like, they will have to think about that. Or they might think, oh, can I think of a number where, what to, like, well, are they going to think about it in that way?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you said, right, come up with another one. And then it's like, well, now come up with an interesting one. And we had some really nice different examples in that. So, like, Paul Rodrigo, who I was sitting with, he did a trig expression there.
Nice.
So he had like sine squared plus, it was really good.
Good.
And then we talked about like interesting examples. We had like a difference of two squares and stuff like that, or like a non-monic. And then you said, right, and so that's your kind of boundary example, because you said that's like, how far can you push this concept? And then in the bottom right box, we're writing something that can't be factorised, but someone might think it can be. So this is basically the common mistakes, or the non-example of an expression that can be factorised. And that was really interesting, because like talking about what could go down there, and it could be something where there is no. So I had x squared minus 2 there, and you could factorise that if you put a root 2 in each bracket. But then David had one which was I think like x squared plus 5 plus 10 or something, where the numbers just don't work. But it was. It was we had good discussions about it, and so would students. And I think that was a really accessible task, and one that would just create a lot of thinking, which is just what we want to do.
Yes.
Like, if we can get them thinking, then we're doing the right thing. And I thought it was a really nice format. And then you showed two other formats, which were sort of similar ideas. They're generating examples, and they're doing this thing where they're discussing them in pairs, they're discussing them as a class, and there's a whole load of drawing out misconceptions. And also, like that, I like that bit where you said about how the kind of boundary example then tips over into a non-example, and them understanding that point means they've got a really deep understanding of the concept. So I really, really enjoyed that. It was fantastic.
Thanks, Jo. It's very, very kind. Yeah, and what I will say is you've got to know, I didn't mention this in the session, but your subject knowledge has got to be pretty good, right? Because, and for a lot of non-specialists, it's problematic, this. So even, I'll give you an example here. So one I did in a school where there were some non-specialists and people who had never taught A-level or even taught higher tier GCSE. So one of the ones I did was fraction equivalent to 2/3.
Yeah.
So give me an example. So some 4/6, fine.
Yeah.
20 over 30, fine. Then it got to the interesting one.
Yeah.
So somebody had put down 1 over 1.5.
Okay.
So then we had a discussion, because is that a fraction equivalent to 2/3 or not? Because, and then like some teachers were like, yeah, it is, and some teachers were like, well, no, it's not. So then it really makes you think very carefully about your definition of the concept of a fraction.
Yeah.
So if you're going to do something like it's a lot easier to ask kids questions where you know the answers.
Yeah.
it's a risky game,
yeah,
but a worthwhile game to throw it out to the kids because they could come back with something.
Yeah, because
who knows?
It doesn't feel good as a teacher when you don't know and you say, actually, I'm not sure that it's one, and it's a bit of a horrible moment
as
a teacher.
Yes.
But so, what was your conclusion on that? Do you think that is an equivalent fraction?
No, I think it's equivalent, but not a fraction.
Really?
Yeah.
That would be an integer.
But the thing is, with these boundary examples, some of them are like going to be clearly wrong. Some of those kind of edge cases, you can say to kids, look, this is an interesting one. You'll never have to make this decision or anything, like in an exam, but it's just worth us having this. And it always draws out these problematic ones.
Your first example, I love the way it linked so perfectly to my area session, because I had spoken about finding areas of triangles and the common misconception and then you said, right, draw a triangle with an area of 12 square centimetres, draw another one, draw an interesting one, and then draw one where there's a common mistake that people make. And then, so I suppose maybe not everyone did this, but my one was where they used the non-perpendicular height. But yeah, really nice link. It's almost like we planned it.
There we go, Joe. Right, okay. So now I've got tip 4 and 5 are both from Nathan Day's session.
Yes.
So Nathan did one on interweaving with a focus on reciprocals, but then branched off into other stuff. So I'll do one first, then I'll throw it to you.
Yep.
So I just had a make sure you do interweaving was my simple one.
Yep.
It's very powerful. So for those of you not aware, interweaving, I get the sense it only really works in maths, or certainly works a lot easier in maths.
Yeah.
So it's this notion that you're mixing concepts that kids have experienced in the past in the current one. But what's good about Nathan, he doesn't just do the obvious, does he? It's not just like chuck a decimal into a parameter question.
Oh, he's very creative.
And if you haven't been on his website, what is it?
Interwovermaths.com?
Interwovermaths.com, that's exactly what it is. He's got some lovely examples. So the reasons he gave for why you should mix implied stuff is good for retrieval, it allows kids to spot connections, and it's almost by definition good for multi-step problem solving because you're dealing with two different concepts.
Yeah.
It's never just straightforward questions. So if you're not a regular interweaver as part of your normal teaching practice, the tip would be chucking in the mix.
Yeah, and some of the examples he showed were incredibly challenging.
Yes,
like, as in,
yes.
We were like, oh, I can't do this.
Really
hard examples. And it was interesting, reciprocals of standard form. Like, that really got us thinking. So because he was focused a lot on reciprocals, our slightly silly tip was, let's say, think about how you get students to write their answer. So that's the non-silly way of saying it. Because I found this before. Say you're doing a question on a reciprocal on the board, and you say, what's the reciprocal of 5?
Yeah.
Then you write down, there's not a symbol. There's not a symbol to write for this reciprocal. Do you see what I mean? So you just
what
write.
Do you mean?
So you can write, so what's the reciprocal of 5?
And you don't put equals.
Then you just write,
right, okay, yeah, yeah,
and then
yeah,
they
yeah,
will
yeah.
put equals.
Yeah,
and
okay,
I'm like, don't
you.
Put 5
yeah,
equals 1/5.
Yes, okay.
And they always use this equal sign. So I was sitting next to David and I said, I want a symbol, which I decided was an upside down R, but he didn't really like that. So we're going to come up with something better.
Okay,
but so I was saying, it's like, I want them to write upside down R equals 1/5. And I was just, we need some kind of symbol there because students will write equals.
They will, yeah.
And so it was interesting because we were trying loads of wonderful reciprocal questions, and every time I was just had this frustration of the fact there's not a symbol to represent reciprocal. So that is not really a tip, other than keep an eye on how your students write their answers and don't accept them writing an equals when they shouldn't have written an equals. So I've turned that into a tip.
That's a good
tip. But really
tip.
I'm just telling you that I'm making up a new symbol.
that's good. That's very good. And my final one, again from Nathan's session, I like the bit he did at the end. And this is almost, you know how obviously I do SSDD problems, same surface, different depth. Nathan does a lot, and Helen Constantine is good at this as well, of doing questions that have the same deep structure, but on the surface look different. So Helen does a really good selection of Pythagoras questions where even if you know it's Pythagoras, it's still challenging.
Right.
As opposed to a ladder leaning against a wall where once you know it's Pythagoras, there's no challenge. And I really like Nathan's idea. He calls it interweaving out, where he had 6 questions all from different areas of math. So I wrote these down here. He had solving simultaneous equations.
Given a point on the line, what's the equation of the line?
Nth term of a linear sequence.
Yeah.
And so completely different areas of mathematics, but his point was they all require kids to correct something.
Yeah.
So adapt the correct the cancel out something from the simultaneous equations with the nth term, correct it from a times table to the nth term, and so on. And again, I just want the thought of doing that, drawing like almost kind of picking a big idea in maths,
yes,
and explicitly drawing the connections by presenting it. You can imagine it like GCSE revision. Once the kids have done all those areas,
yeah,
put that together as a, like almost like a retrieval starter. And the kids get all the retrieval, but then say, look, there's a connection between these questions. I just thought it was really strong.
I wouldn't have spotted it. Like, I couldn't see what he meant when he was saying there was a connection.
Yes.
But I really liked the way he explained, you know, where it said a line goes through the point 440,
yes.
What's the equation of the line? No, there must have been, it was parallel to something. Yeah. So we knew the gradient was 4. And I thought it was just, I like the way he explained it, where he said, so we know it's y equals 4x, but if it was y equals 4x,
yes,
then you get 4, but you want to have 40.
Yes.
So what do you have to add to that?
Correction.
And it was just
nice.
it was quite a nice, the explanation, like even the way he explained the completing the square one isn't the way we typically explain completing the square.
Yes.
So it was quite a nice way of looking at it. But yeah, I agree. It was interesting to find these common threads, which is something that Anne Watson was looking at with some John Stuart tasks. She was trying to look at a load of John Stuart tasks, and she found threads that went through them,
yes,
in a kind of similar way, where they seem like they're unrelated tasks, but they've got something, some deep maths in common.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah, he's good.
Yeah.
He's a good way about him as well. I like his style.
Yes.
I think he's good. I think he's good as Nathan. Well,
Joe,
there we go. That was a good format, wasn't it? That was quick, snappy.
Yeah.
What do you think of that? So now let's just tell the listeners, you're going to try and get back home down south.
We're going to attempt to get a train that's running tonight. Who knows? We'll have a go.
All right. Well, Joe Morgan, as ever, pleasure catching up with you. And thank you for joining us on the Tips for Teachers podcast.
Thanks very much, Craig.